Today is October 19th, 2018. This is a Society of Women Engineers Grassroots Oral History Project interview with Dr. Sandra Hyland. The interviewer is Troy Eller English. We are at the WE 18 Annual Conference in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Sandra has spent nearly 40 years in electrical engineering and material science, specializing in semiconductor manufacturing, infrared sensor arrays, integrated circuits, and solar photovoltaic devices. She received a bachelor's degree in electrical engineering from Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute in 1977, a master's degree in electrical engineering from Rutgers in 1979, and a master's degree and ultimately PhD in materials science and engineering from Cornell in 1991. Her career has spanned both industry and government, with positions held at the NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory, IBM, National Research Council, Tokyo Electron, and BAE Systems. She is currently a process integration engineer at Northrop Grumman, where she is working on semiconductors for the company's Advanced Technology Laboratory in Maryland. She holds two patents. Sandra is a fellow life member of the Society of Women Engineers. She was a charter member of the Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, SWE section, when it was formed in 1975, and has been very active in the SWE Baltimore, Washington section since the early 1990s, including serving 2 years as president and many years as section representative. At the society level, she has served on the Audit, Bylaws, Ethics, and Tellers Committee, and the SWE Magazine Editorial Board, among many other contributions to the society, and this year is the chair-elect of the Ethics Committee. Thank you for joining me today.
Thank you.
To begin with, can you tell me where and when you were born?
I was born in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
All right.
In 1954.
And can you tell me about your family growing up?
My father has a degree in physics from Columbia, and he worked at Honeywell when I was born, but in my living memory, he worked for the U.S. government, worked for the Navy Department. He did navigation systems for submarines, and he worked there for many years till he retired, and he retired as early as he could and then enjoyed himself very much in his later years. My mother was, she was a medical secretary, and they both were in the Navy during World War II. My mother was, having been a medical secretary, was posted to where they were doing chemical warfare, so because she was aware of all the medical terminology and could do shorthand and things like that. So she spent most of the war there. My father was a Navy pilot on the one of the carriers in the Pacific. And growing up, my mother had a variety of different jobs, and just she worked at a mental health facility, which was nice because when I was a teenager, I would work there in the summer and do filing and all those important things, and I can Xerox with the best of them. When I was growing up, it was a good time to grow up. I grew up outside of Washington, D.C. in the Virginia suburbs, and it was a time when everybody was having kids. I was part of like the middle of the baby boom, and so everybody in the neighborhood had all kinds of children, every age, and it was just one of those very communal neighborhood that I grew up in.
Okay.
It's kind of idyllic.
Did you have siblings?
I have an older brother. He's 2.5 years older than I am.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. What led you to college and to your interest in engineering?
When I was in high school, I had no interest or even knowledge of engineering, although maybe my father being an engineer probably should have triggered that idea. When I left high school, I actually applied for college to get a degree in history, because I've always been very interested in history and read a lot of books about history and things. But the colleges wisely figured out that I was not really dedicated to it. And so I didn't actually get in anywhere. And I ended up going with a friend of mine to go to school in England for a year. So I did this kind of last year of high school in England. And while I was there, it was a girls' school, which I think may have had some bearing on the fact that I sat down and really thought about what did I do well. And I thought, well, you know, I like math and physics. Why wouldn't I go for engineering? And I hit just at the right time, because it was just about when Title IX kicked in. And everybody thinks of Title IX as sports, but the engineering schools had, they also had a tremendous imbalance, and they were actually out looking for women. So I just hit right on the cusp of that. So I was the second year I went to Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, and I was the second year where they had a significant number of women, significant enough that they had to find dorm space for all of us. Because before that, they'd had, you know, onesie twosies, and they could find spaces in other places. But I don't remember exactly the moment I thought of it, but when I took stock of what I enjoyed, what I enjoyed and what I did well, engineering, as I say, I kind of felt like, well, why wouldn't I do that?
So you said that you were in like the second year of a lot of women coming mm-hmm. into Rensselaer.
Well, a lot, yes. Relatively a lot.
Right. What was the environment like, and what was your experience like?
The first year I was there, I lived in a dorm. It was a 3-floor dorm, and they had taken the top floor and made the top floor all women because there was just one bathroom on the floor. So I guess they just had to take the whole floor. But the other two floors were men. It was really a very weirdly supportive environment just from that floor. I mean, the school itself was still struggling with the idea that there were women coming in, and some of the professors were thinking, like, it's all changed since women got here. And I thought, well, get with it then. Not my problem. I don't remember ever feeling like I stood out, but a friend of mine came to visit, and she was at the University of Virginia, and she's my high school friend, and she came to visit, and she goes, this is very strange, because you'd be there, and there'd be like 5 women there, but to me, that became kind of a normal environment. Mm-hmm. So I didn't feel like it was that odd until she pointed it out.
So there were other women in most of your engineering courses at this point, or
in my early years, the first 2 years, you took a lot of general courses. So you took math courses and chemistry and physics, and there were always, you know, maybe 2 or 3 other women. When I started going into the electrical engineering classes, though, there were only maybe 125 electrical engineering majors, and there were 2 women. And I was reflecting on this the other day. I don't think Danielle and I ever took a class together. So I was often the only woman in the room.
Okay. What did that feel like? Did it feel normal or intimidating?
It felt pretty normal at the time. Looking back on it, maybe if I'd been more aware, I would have been intimidated. But I had a lot of men friends in the club, because you kind of have to, because that's the environment you're in. So I knew enough people. I had enough close friends that I felt like I was taking classes with a friend. So the fact that they weren't women didn't really stand out to me. I think that one of the strange things was that the professors I had the most trouble with were the humanities professors. The engineering professors, I think, just felt like, if you do well on the test, I don't care who you are. But the humanities professors would not call on me in class, or they would call on me every time. And it was just, I did a test with one of the professors where we would have these little 4-person panels. And so the first time I sat on the left and he asked me the first question, so I started moving around. He always asked me the first question. And I finally, in the last time we did this, I said, like, why do you always ask me first? He goes, I don't do that. Like, yeah, you do. So it seemed pretty normal. And I didn't really feel out of place because we were all trying to learn all the technical stuff. And so as long as I focused on that, and I had enough women friends that when we went out, we could, you know, there'd be 3 or 4 of us that would go places together. So it was, I don't know, I look back on it very fondly.
Okay. I saw that you were an undergraduate assistant during your time there, working in a lab, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about that, how you got that position and how it sort of informed your future education?
My advisor, who Dr. Borrego was from, he was from Mexico, and he was the first person from Mexico I ever met. He had a laboratory, and I in chatting with him, said that I was looking for something, and he said, oh, I need somebody to build I was building some kind of box where you had to wire things up. And I had, in high school, my father being an electrical engineer, we had built a color television. So I would come home from work and I told him, like, I can solder anything. I could stick any two things together with solder. So I got to, like, drill holes and put in connectors and solder things together and things like that. And it was, I worked with one of the actual graduate students who needed this box for his research. So it was kind of fun. I got to make something with my hands, and it's kind of a led into other work that I do, because it, you know, being an electrical engineer, it's all about guiding the electrons where you want them to go. And it was my first experience to design it myself and build it myself.
Okay. Do you have any particular positive or negative memories from your time as an undergraduate?
I have sort of a general positive feeling. I'm still in touch with my my roommate. She now lives in Vancouver, Canada, and so I see her every once in a while. And my best friend lives in New York City, so I see her, you know, a couple times a year, but we talk on the phone. So I have a general good feeling about it. There are certain things that maybe episodes that stand out where I felt like that it was a bit odd. I mean, we didn't have a doctor on campus, and that was a little strange, you know. I don't know, that was very odd, but it didn't seem so at the time. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Negative memories, there are certain things where you felt a little unsafe because you'd be a woman walking home after dark, but Troy, New York was not a particularly dangerous area. It wasn't like there were like people on the street following you, but every once in a while you'd feel I have several memories of times where I would go on the main road as opposed to taking the back road and things like that, but in general, I have very positive memories of it.
Okay. While you were an undergraduate, you helped to charter the SWE section there.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me how, why and how and what you did?
Well, let me say, I was a charter member, but I wasn't one of the people who drove the charter. I had never heard of Society of Women Engineers, and I think there were three women who, I don't know how they knew about it, but they said, oh, we should start a section. And I thought, well, that's a good idea. So they were the ones who really drove the whole, you know, get the members together, do the application, find a counselor, all that stuff. But I was a charter member of that.
Okay. Okay. And what did you do as, at that time, it was a student section. Mm-hmm. What did you do at that time as a SWE section?
I don't really actually remember doing anything. I think I was either a junior or a senior, so I think at that time I was more immersed in my trying to figure out what I wanted to do as an electrical engineer than as a woman electrical engineer. And I don't have any particular memories of anything we did.
Okay.
We must have done something.
How did you make the decision to go directly to grad school?
I was standing outside my advisor's office one time, and I guess maybe the fall of my senior year, because I had to talk to him about what classes to take, and I was just reading the announcements on the board, and one of them was, I'm looking for somebody to be a grad student to work on solar energy, and I thought, well, that sounded really neat, and that was at Rutgers, which is, the entire title is Rutgers, the State University of New Jersey, and it just sounded really interesting, and I applied, and the advisor that I actually went to work for at Rutgers was like, I didn't think anybody ever read those things. I said, well, you found one. You found one person who read it. So it was just that I was just kind of browsing, and I thought, well, that sounds really good, because I hadn't really, to go back to one of your other questions about the negative responses, it was difficult, the interviewers who came to interviews students at that time, they were kind of told they had to hire a woman, but they all wanted the one woman. Like, they wanted the person with the straight A average, and that was not me. I was not, so nobody really wanted me. So I hadn't found anything that I was going to do with my degree, and I was just taking a device physics course, and that was the first electrical engineering course that I thought I could really do this, because leading up to that, I took like power transmission and circuit design and things, and none of those really grabbed me. But I took the device physics class, and this was the solar energy was for photovoltaic, so it was a device physics continuing. So it was in an area I had recently found that I really liked, and I didn't have anything else, so I thought, well, why not?
Okay. I feel like I'm missing a question somewhere. Okay. Okay. So can you tell me about your time at Rutgers and your work as a grad assistant there?
Mm-hmm. It was, I was just getting a master's degree. It ended up taking 2 years. I don't know how long it was supposed to take. It was my first experience where I had to write papers and go to conferences, and that was quite a transition for me. But we had, as I remember, maybe 3 graduate students who were getting their PhD, and I got to work with them. And actually, I just recently linked up with them again through ResearchGate. They just mm-hmm. kind of popped up on ResearchGate, and so we've gone back and forth, which is kind of one of those funny things about LinkedIn and ResearchGate and all that. You find all these old people. They were very good at like helping me with what I needed to do. I got to teach them how to solder things, because I can solder anything. bringing my skills to bear. I didn't teach any classes there. It was just I took classes every semester and did my research, and it was kind of fun in the photovoltaics community. Most everybody has a calibrated light that you measure all your things with, but we would just go up on the roof, which was kind of neat. It's like you get to go up on the roof, you can see everything. Not everybody gets to go on the roof. I just remember being up on the roof going, this is really cool. I enjoyed it there. My advisor left after my first year and went to University of Buffalo, I think. So for my last year, he was kind of in and out, so the other grad students a little bit stepped in to help me mm-hmm. figure that out.
Okay. And then you decided to continue on to your PhD at that time?
No. I went to work at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California after that, because they were doing solar photovoltaics and I kind of fit right into that. And that was tremendous. I was there 4 years, I think it was. And my boss there was really good at helping me to transition from being a student to being a real engineer in terms of, and I now give people the advice that he gave me, which is everything you've done up till now has been to demonstrate what you know. But now that you're a professional, you have to understand what your audience needs to know. Don't fill in with irrelevant background. It's not an activity report. You are trying to communicate technical information. And so the young engineers that I work with now, I try to say, like, this is not an activity report. And he was, my boss then was Chris Kalawad, he was just really good at understanding what I needed to know and when I needed to know it and kind of pushing me in the right directions at the right time.
Okay. Can you tell me what you were working on at the propulsion laboratory?
It was at a time when we thought we had an energy crisis. So we were working on converting space photovoltaic. So every space mission that goes, that's either Earth or towards the Earth, uses photovoltaics to generate power. If you go away from the Earth, the sunlight's not enough to power. So they tend to use nuclear sorts of power generation. So Jet Propulsion Lab was responsible. It was the NASA Center for all unmanned space stuff. So they had a real expertise in photovoltaics. And the idea was that we would take the knowledge of space photovoltaics and then convert that into terrestrial power generation. And it's quite gratifying to me to see like all the photovoltaic stuff, because 30 years ago our goal was 50 cents a kilowatt hour, and we've hit that in the last few years, and it's really, I don't know when we actually crossed that line, but you can start to see it. It's becoming economically feasible to generate that way, and a lot of places are taking advantage, like putting them on top of parking garages, because that acreage is already taken care of. And so you could just generate power from your parking garage instead of just having cars sitting out there. So I worked on that. This is how it actually led to my interest in material sciences. I did a comparison of a lot of different ways of growing silicon. So if you make a computer chip, the price of the silicon is insignificant. But if you make a solar cell, the price of the silicon is about half of the price of the final thing. So we were looking for cheaper ways to make silicon, and I was building devices and doing the comparison and trying to figure out how to maximize the efficiency and how to compare across different ways of growing silicon. It was really quite fascinating thing, and as I say, it's really gratifying to see it kind of coming into normal use now.
Okay. What was the atmosphere or energy like at NASA or at the laboratory?
It's a very academic environment, and our group of, I think there were maybe 12 engineers in our group, we were half women, which was very odd at the time. But as I say, my boss was quite, I don't want to say enlightened, because that sounds like everybody else is in the dark, but he really had a very progressive attitude towards the diversity of opinion and the diversity of capabilities and those sorts of things. So he really had built a group that was quite different from anything else. I don't think I've ever actually worked in a group like that since. It was really very motivating. And the Jet Propulsion Lab itself is just a great place. It was during the, I worked there during the Voyager encounters. And so we would sit in the cafeteria, and as the data was streaming down from the Voyager, they would just be showing it in the cafeteria. And so you'd just see these images of planets just appearing before your eyes. And it was a really neat place to work.
Okay. So what prompted you to leave then and to pursue your PhD?
I was a program manager, which I look back on it now and I'm like, what did I know about program management? I was a program manager for the photovoltaic program that we were running at JPL. And I just kind of realized that my interest was very technical and very academic. And most of the people that I saw that looked kind of like what I wanted to do had PhDs. And I always joke that I realized I wasn't going to take a step up until they all moved up, and some of them were not that smart. So I had to get my own PhD. So I can go around them. That's probably not true, but, you know. But one of the programs that we had was with Cornell University. And so I knew the professor, and I knew what he was working on. And I thought, well, you know, I really want this. And so I ended up leaving to go back to school.
Can you tell me about your experience there?
At Cornell?
Yes.
It was very interesting because I was changing from electrical engineering to material science. So I had to take a couple of undergraduate classes in material science. And I was in this class with seniors in a material science. And I'm thinking, this seems very easy to me. Whereas when I'd been a senior coming through school, all the senior classes seemed really hard. And I realized that one of the things I had learned from working was how to identify what the important points are. So I wasn't trying to learn everything. I had figured out kind of what the key points were and what was going to show up on the exam and what I needed to know for my research. And I wasn't trying to learn everything just in case they asked it. And it was quite revelatory because the poor seniors were struggling to learn everything, and I kind of pick and choose and figure out what I needed to know. And I guess I had a better framework to hang the information on than they did. You know, they were trying to like still build the framework, and I already had the framework. So that was kind of an interesting revelation. As one of my friends says, like, you should not be kicking their asses. They've been doing this for 4 years. You just got here. I was like, I can't help you. So that was kind of interesting. It was my advisor was Dieter Ass is a very funny German guy, and he's always kind of very, very German, but it seemed like he would seem very serious, but he wasn't a very serious person. And he was a lot of fun, but he was unbelievably smart. And he could explain most complicated things to you in just such simple language that you're like, well, how did I not get that before? You know, it's not that hard. He's really good at that. And he, one of the most valuable exercises that he, another thing that I try to do with our young engineers, one of the most valuable exercises he did with me one time was I was giving a presentation at a conference. And so we were going to practice, right? So I gave the talk and then he got up with my slides and gave the same talk. And I'm like, oh, that is a lot better. So then I got up and gave the talk, and then he got up and gave it. I think we went through 3 or 4 iterations, and I got better every time because I could learn from his technique of how you transition between the slides and how you reiterate your higher level, you know, the thought you're trying to convey without getting into the details. And that was that's probably the most valuable thing I took away from grad school, was that ability to really think about what the people who are listening to you need to hear from you, and that your slides are only for the background for that, right? Mm-hmm. The slides, you don't have to read the slides. You could say these things. I've since modified that a little bit because later in my career, which I'm sure you'll get to, I worked for a Japanese company, and the engineers I worked with, they tend to have a better reading comprehension than the listening comprehension, which I think is probably common if you're working in a language that's not your own, that you don't speak every day. So now I do tend to put a lot more on my slides that maybe is obvious, but it helped for the people who are very visual. They can read it and maybe they don't hear you say something, but if it's important enough, it goes on the slide. Mm-hmm. So we took classes for, I guess, a year and a half, and then had to take an A exam, the Advancement to Candidacy exam, which is an oral exam where you have your major advisor and 2 minor advisors and then another person from the department to kind of be the referee. But I think it's changed now. It was an oral exam, and it's just terrifying in its potential scope because it's whatever's on their mind they can start asking you about. And it's just, as I say, it's terrifying in its potential scope. And that was, I managed to get through it. I was a little stressed. But I think that one of the lessons I learned from that is, like, if you don't know the answer, so there's no point in trying to bluff because they know the answer. They didn't ask the question if they didn't know the answer. And that was, it went as well as it could go. Let's put it that way.
Well, you made it past it.
So. I made it past that, so I figure that's good enough. We did have actually before that, at the end of the first year, that you would go and they had an exam where all of the grad students, I think there were maybe 30 of us in the year, and you would talk to all the individual professors, and they each had a topic that they would talk to you about, and then they would all get together and rack and stack. And I just remember I went into my advisor, and his topic was polymers, which I know almost nothing about. I have, my chemistry background is very weak. And so he asked me these questions. And then luckily it was only 15 minutes. So as he's opening the door to let me go on to my whatever the next thing was, he goes, well, I hope to see you under better circumstances soon. I'm like, oh, dear. And then all the other, of course, the other students are waiting to go in. They're like, oh, no. Yes, but I got through it. I'm fine. I was number 9. I'm okay. I'm good with 9. It's perfectly good. And then after that, after the advancement to candidacy, it was all research from there on. And you do your research, write your thesis, try to come up with a good idea of what the thesis is about, and get up and defend it. And I always tell people who are nervous about their thesis defense, I was like, you know more about this than anybody in that room. There's no need to be nervous.
What was your research and your thesis?
My research was on mechanical properties of silicon, which at the time I thought was completely irrelevant. But now with MEMS devices and things, people are going back to that kind of thing. I did a lot of modeling of silicon crystal growth, and I tried to come up with, like, if you could describe your thesis in one sentence, what would it be? And what I figured out was you can't know enough about a silicon crystal before it grows to model it. There's too many factors going into it. But it was interesting. I did get to go to the Göttingen University in Germany. I got a 3-month fellowship there during that, and that was I came up with one of the big ideas in my as big as my thesis was. One of my theme ideas for my thesis while I was there, I worked with a very famous German professor there, Peter Hassen, and it was that was quite a learning experience too. I work with the German grad students, and I had a good time.
What was the environment like at Cornell at that time?
Well, in material science tends to attract a lot of women, so we had a significant number of women. We did have a couple professors that I think would not have survived in today's environment. And I did call one of them out on it, and I think he was a little upset with me, but not my problem. Because having worked and gone back, I had a lot more courage than people who'd gone straight through, who sort of saw professors as, people to look up to, whereas I had been a program manager and I'd been an engineer and I'd work with them as peers, and so it was for me it was a little easier to call people out and say, "Yeah, I don't think you meant to say it like that. Didn't that come across right?" So the environment was generally pretty positive. It's a big university, and having come from Rensselaer, which was 85% men, to go to a university that had arts and history and a vet school, and just it was really kind of nice, and I love Ithaca, and I would move back if I could find a job there.
Tell me about after you finished your doctorate, mm-hmm. you moved on to IBM. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me what you did there?
I can. It was a funny thing. It was, what was it, 1991. So then the job market was not that great. So I was, luckily with grad school, there's no actual end date. So you can kind of negotiate. I went to a conference and I met a guy from IBM. And I guess he went back and recommended, we just talked. At the conference, I have no memory of saying, I'm looking for a job. Do you want to hire me or anything? So he must have said something, because then they kind of reached out to me, and it was IBM in Manassas, Virginia, and I went around asking people, what does IBM do in Manassas, Virginia? And everyone went, I don't know. And we had a lot of IBM people, because Cornell had a very close affiliation with IBM in Fishkill and IBM in Burlington, and actually IBM in Binghamton as well. So people would come and get their PhD, and IBM would pay for it. So there were a lot of IBM people around, but everybody was kind of like, what did IBM do in Manassas, Virginia? And it turned out it was the federal system. So it was all the government, making the chips and the boards and everything for satellites and space stuff. So a lot about radiation and those kinds of things. It was nice because that's where I grew up. It was home for me. It never occurred to me when I got my PhD that I would be able to move back home. I just kind of assumed I would go wherever the jobs were, but there it was in Virginia. It was very interesting. It was my first foray into manufacturing, and it turns out I really love manufacturing. I came out of Cornell, and everybody's like, oh, I'm going to be a professor. I'm going to go into research. I'm going to go to Bell Labs. I'm going to do this stuff. And here I am, trying to figure out yield curves and doing Paretos of defects and trying to figure out how to get rid of them and how not to screw up everything else while you fix that one defect. And I just loved it. And IBM at the time, it was not a great place to be a woman. The year I was hired in, they hired 10 engineers. They hired 5 men and 5 women. So they were doing their best in terms of hiring. But then once we got there, it was not a very good environment. And some of the young engineers, again, having worked and come back and also being a very tall person, people don't tend to mess with me too much. But some of the younger engineers were sort of tiny and cute. And the technicians would just, they were merciless to those people. They would say things that if their mother heard them saying it, they would, mothers would be embarrassed. And I'm just thinking like, you're at work, why are you talking like that? So within, I left there after about 2.5 years. I was the last of the 5 women there. They had all left because it was just a toxic environment. And I made many good friends there. I still have good friends from that work experience. But the environment was just not good for women there.
Okay, so that prompted you to go to the... That's when you went to the National Academies?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It was the National Research Council at the time. There was the National Academy of Sciences, the National Academy of Engineering, and the Institute of Medicine have a separate entity called the National Research Council, and I believe that's still it, but now they kind of all go under the National Academies rubric. IBM at the time was downsizing, and Lou Gerstner had just taken over IBM, and he never came to Manassas, so we sort of figured... things were on the chopping block. I had the opportunity. They were giving us courses in how to write your resume. That was kind of a big hint too. So I ended up. I saw a magazine advertisement again. It was just like randomly. I just saw this saying the National Research Council was looking for what do they call staff officers? Is what it was called. And I applied and I went to interview and it was really quite interesting and a lot of material science, which was kind of nice. And I pretty much figured I was on the layoff list for IBM, so I jumped out as soon as I could and went to work at the National Research Council.
Okay. And what did you do there?
I was a senior staff officer because I have a PhD. The general idea of what a staff officer does is somebody in the National Research Council, it's almost all government entities, will come and they say, I need a report to tell me what to do about this topic. And the staff officer and, of course, their, you know, the staff director and all those other people, you try to figure out, okay, what's the main question? What sort of expertise do you need to answer that question? And then you formulate a committee. So you try to find people with all the expertise. If you need somebody who knows about, you know, human factors, and you need somebody who knows about radiation, and you need some... So you comb through literature or whatever and try to find people who want to, because it's a volunteer thing. That's another thing. There were people that didn't want to volunteer. And then you say, yeah, we're putting this together and we'll have 4 meetings and you'll need to write a chapter on this. And you gather those people together. And then once you've gathered them together, you have to then start cracking the whip and making them actually produce. Because in the end, what the National Research Council sells is a report with recommendations. And recommendations based on the expertise of the people that you've put on the committee. But also they're all peer-reviewed, right? So it is these people's opinions, but it's a pretty well-vetted thing. And if you have an opinion, the reviewers will not let you put that in there if you do not have data that shows, you know, this is why the committee thinks that. So I did several of those. And the first one I did, I think, was of most interest to people because it was at the time the U.S. was redesigning the paper money. And it was so the early, mid-90s. It was the first time since 1929 they had redesigned the paper money. And they had put in a lot. They felt like they had a good handle on the security stuff. But what our committee did was talk about what people with low vision could, like, how do you make paper money easier for people with low vision to use? And, you know, low vision ranges from, you know, the smoky bar situation to people who have no sight at all or completely blind. And that was really interesting because we had people who knew about money design. We had people who knew about how blind people navigate the world. We had people who knew about the various levels of vision and vision loss. And it's, you know, it's not, we kind of think of things as just going dim, but there's so many ways that people have low eyesight. And so how do you find something that works for all of those people? And if you look on the back of the money, there's the giant number, in sans serif, which is our recommendation. I don't know that they designed it particularly well. It doesn't look that beautiful to me. It looks kind of like it got mimeographed on there later. But we recommended that they have a large number and sans serif, so not fancy, right? No little squigglies around, because that confuses people who have low vision as well. That it be color. So if you look at the number, the number has a different color for every denomination. We, at the time, apparently someone in Congress had gotten wind of the fact that we were discussing color. And so they passed a law that said the back has to be green because it's the green back. So we couldn't change the back. But if you look on the front, you'll see there's a lot more different colors on the front. The other recommendation that we made was to follow the lead of 90% of the world, which is to have different size money for different denominations. And in the end, that was really the only thing. If you are blind, that's the only way you're going to tell a $20 bill from a $5 bill. But the U.S. government, and I think a lot of the population, they're emotionally invested in the you know, the greenback. It looks like this, right? You can't change the size. And the funny thing was that every time we recommended it, somebody would say, I'd have to buy a new wallet. I thought that was the strangest thing, but it was just like, that was the common response. Like, well, wouldn't that be good for the wallet industry? I mean, everybody has to buy a new wallet. And I said, well, you know, the people in Europe, they seem to be able to do this with a regular wallet. And the other thing was the vending machines. But the vending machines, the guts of the vending machine are the same. It's just that front plate is the only thing that determines what size of thing you can put in there. So as I say, in Europe, they seem to be able to handle it. A lot of the South American countries, I think, go along with, they try to follow the U.S., so they'll have the same size, but very few countries in the world have everything the same size. Mm-hmm. So that was my first study. But in the meanwhile, I started doing a bunch on aviation security, so a lot of stuff on checked baggage screening, carry-on baggage screening, people screening, and there's just maybe eight of those that I worked on over the time. And that was fascinating because I got to do a lot of airport tours. So it's like, it's really, if you ever have the chance to go into the guts of an airport, it's pretty neat. There's a lot of stuff down there. I was telling somebody earlier that we went to the Denver airport pretty much right after it opened. And I don't know if you remember this, when they were like the first ones, they were going to have this high-speed luggage thing, and they had the trains that went between, and it was very revolutionary. And we went, and we were downstairs, and we were, you know, the bags were coming down, and we were going to see how this whole thing worked. And we're all standing there, and we see a bag coming, and it comes down, and there's a guy sitting at a desk, and he like stops the bag, and he reads what's on the ticket, and then he types in where it's going. And we were all so disappointed. We were expecting this whole like, but no, there's, I'm sure it's different now, but at the time we were kind of like, wait. So he's stopping each one and reading it and typing in, you know, DCA, MIA, MSB. It was very, very disappointing. But I did a lot of work on that, and I have continued since I left there in 1998. But since then, I've been on several other committees as a volunteer, and it's a lot more fun being a volunteer than a staff person, but I still enjoy it.
What prompted you to leave that position?
I left that position. It was very stressful, for one thing, because you're always trying to poke at people. But a friend of mine that I had worked with at IBM had left IBM, and then he went to work for Tokyo Electron, and we were just talking one day, and he says, well, I need somebody to come work for me. I'm like, well, okay, that's back into technology. And you know, I really missed the actual hands-on technology stuff. So that was kind of just, you know, coincidental. I always tell people, if you're in the semiconductor industry, you have to be nice to everybody because they'll come around again. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it was a friend I hadn't seen in years, and I was just talking to him one day, and he's like, don't you want to come and work for me? And I said, okay. There I was.
What year did you?
That was 1998.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And what was your position there?
So that was Tokyo Electron Laboratories, I believe. It's always known in the industry as TEL, T-E-L. I was a process engineer, I believe is my title. So Tokyo Electron, makes equipment for semiconductor manufacturing, and I worked in etch. My whole world was etch at the time. So we made etchers, and we would sell to all the various the customers. So IBM was a big customer, and IBM at the time had a joint venture with Toshiba called Dominion Semiconductor, and that was in Manassas, Virginia. So I was back in Manassas. So my job was to work with the customer engineers and make sure that if they were having any frustration with our tools, to make sure that they were addressed. So I was a liaison between the customer and our factory in Japan, and we also had a factory in Beverly, Massachusetts at the time. So going back to the factory and saying they're having trouble with this, and let the factory engineers come up with a solution and then try to get it back in there. And also to make sure that our factory guys knew, like, to read the customers well enough to know where they were going and have to make sure that our equipment was going to be there. And I loved that, the kind of rough and tumble of the equipment vendor world, because it's just like every time you got a win, I mean, these etchers cost $12 million a piece, right? So like when every time you got a win, it was a pretty big one. So I worked a lot with the IBM engineers, and eventually, like maybe 2 years into it, I was promoted to the manager of the East Coast. We had an East and a Central and a West Coast. And the East Coast was from IBM Burlington and then Fishkill and then down all the way to Aguirre in Florida. So I did a lot of traveling after that, going up and down the East Coast. But I was still the process engineer for the Manassas facility, which then became Micron after some other transition, went Toshiba, then Micron. But I had another engineer who was there day to day, so I could go up and down the East Coast and just make sure everything was good and call the customers and go, is my engineer doing a good job? Like, I had one engineer that the IBM customer had figured out that in Japan there are these certain weeks where everything closes down. In the U.S., we don't have that. So the Japanese managers would have trouble understanding how I could be on vacation, but my customer was working. And the IBM, one of the IBM customers, figured this out. So every time my poor engineer would try to get a vacation in, he would call my manager. He wouldn't call me. He'd call my manager and say, well, I need him to be here. And they kept making him cancel his vacations. And I finally said, you have to go on vacation, because someday they're going to call me up and they're going to say, I need another engineer. This one's all used up. I said, you got to go on vacation. So he went on a cruise, which I thought was very wise, because you can't be called back from a cruise. And he just loved it. And now he goes on a cruise. But he was having trouble, like, disassociating himself, because, again, the IBM guy could kind of figured out a way around that to keep him out. It was sort of this funny use of a cultural difference that wasn't working out for my engineer.
After that, you moved to BAE Systems. Mm-hmm. What prompted that change?
So there was some decision at Tel, and I don't know what it was, that they wanted all of the managers to live in Beverly, Massachusetts. And Manassas, Virginia is very close to home. That's where I wanted to be. So I said, well, I was never particularly great at being a manager, as far as I know. So I said, well, I don't really want to go to Beverly, Massachusetts, but Albany Nanotech had just built this whole new center, and I knew that Tel was moving equipment in there. And I said, but I would go to Albany. So they transferred me to Albany. But as soon as they transferred me to Albany, I knew I was going to get back to Virginia. It just was not an emergency. And so, again, a couple years later, I was in Albany for 2 years, and I loved it there. I liked Albany. And I realized that when you control your own heat and you have a car, the winters aren't as horrible as I remembered from when I was an undergraduate. I saw an advertisement for somebody to work for a company in Manassas, Virginia, and I thought, well, this has got to be BAE Systems. It can't be. It was, and so BAE Systems, actually, the IBM Federal Systems went from IBM to Loral to Lockheed to BAE. So it was the same facility, the same people, right? So I knew people there. So I called my friend Murty, and I said, Murty, what is this? And he goes, I don't know. So he went and he found out that it was a different company, but they were doing work in the facility. And he said, well, do you want to come work for BAE Systems? I'm like, why not? So he said, oh, we're putting together a process integration group, and you'd fit in perfectly. And I'm like, that sounds good. So I went and I interviewed, and the person interviewing me hadn't been there very long. And so as we're walking down the hall, people just keep stopping me because I know everybody who works there. And they're like, you know everybody. I said, yeah, I guess people don't leave. So I ended up going back, and it was a very odd feeling because I knew the people and I knew where everything was. I just had to learn the new technology that they were assigning me to. And, you know, normally you start a new job and you don't, like, everything's new. And in this case, it was just, I only had to learn the one thing. So it was quite comfortable. And that I enjoyed that. I worked for, I did night vision, chips for night vision for the Army and all that other stuff.
Okay. And then you're now at Northrop Grumman.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me about your position there and what you do?
I do a similar thing. I'm a process integration engineer. My main thing I do is try to improve yield, or either try to improve it from where we are or fix it when it goes wrong. Most of the other process integration engineers at Northrop own a product. I'm one of two of the process integration group that don't own a product, and we report actually directly to the second line manager. So we're kind of the jack of all trades sorts of thing. And I've developed a kind of a niche of reading the mil specs and actually understanding how, like, when we make process changes, how we have to do it per the mil specs. It's a little odd that our mission assurance people don't know this, but but it's me today. Today it is me. I'm trying to, one of the younger engineers I think would be very good at it, and so I'm trying to encourage her to kind of get involved in, like, the all the various groups that do mil specs and interpretation of mil specs and stuff, because I can do it as an amateur, but we really need somebody who's dedicated to that, who really understands the processing. So a lot of what I do every day is go to meetings and hear about things that are going wrong, and then go back and do data analysis to try to figure out if we, like, is this really a problem, or are people overreacting to a one-time thing? And it's a lot of fun. It's like I told Claire Dvorak that it's semiconductor detective work.
Mm-hmm. Looking back over your career, are there any particular highlights or lowlights that you can recall?
You know, every time I've left a job has been a very hard transition. Sometimes, like, even if I'm miserable in the job, I hope I try to be very positive and do a good job, even if I just hate what I do every day. Those transitions have been hard, but I feel like I've always gone to something better. It's maybe something different, maybe something where I'll use a little bit more of my capabilities. Now, BAE Systems, I was all set to retire from BAE Systems, but they closed my factory. So we ended up at Northrop Grumman. A whole bunch of us came over, so there's a whole group from BAE over at Northrop Grumman. I mean, the highlights have been the people I've met and certain things that I've done. Like, I always tell people one of my proudest moments when I worked for Tel was when I got IBM to pay $50,000 to change a gas line. Because the IBM manager, who was explaining to me very carefully that this gas line needed to be changed, clearly assumed that Tel was going to pay for it. And I could see I'm facing the IBM manager, and my manager, my Japanese manager, is sitting behind him. And I said, well, you know, Tel is perfectly happy to do that work, but I don't think it's fair to ask my company to pay for it. And I saw my Japanese manager almost like, he's like, got this look of shock on his face. And the IBM manager stops. He goes, yeah, that's okay. So, like, certain things like that stand out, where it was kind of like, huh, that was kind of neat. So I have fond memories like that. And I'm generally a positive person. If it was that negative, I try to let it just wash out. And so I don't really have any things where I was like, oh my God, this was awful. But yeah, I think mostly everything I have is pretty positive.
Okay. Did you have any mentors or advocates in your career that helped propel you along?
I think, I can't put my finger on an individual. I think a lot of, like, my first boss at JPL and my thesis advisor at Cornell, I try to think about, like, what it is I see in them that I think is very effective, and I try to emulate that. I can't really remember anybody that I sat down with and said, what do you think I should do about this? I have to say, though, one time Penny Wersing and I had a long discussion, because at the time I was thinking about leaving the National Academies, and I was like, am I really ready to go back into a technical job? And she came and had lunch, and we just, like, talked through. It was, like, really nice. So I think for Society of Women Engineers, that's one of the things you can do, is you can just say, like, I just, like, and it's not that that person has the answer, but they let you talk through it, and they kind of say, well, here, I'm hearing more passion towards this than I am towards this. Like, maybe you're trying to talk yourself into this because it's more stable, but I hear more passion about this one. So that's a very useful thing. But as I say, I can't put my finger on an individual who's been a mentor. Maybe behind the scenes there, I've had a lot of sponsors, but again, sponsors you don't necessarily even know about, right? You don't know what they're saying about you in the back. But I think a lot of people have stood up for me when I wasn't there too.
Okay. Looking back, is there any advice that you would give your younger self now that you've,
Oh my gosh, I wish that I had been bolder. I was kind of a timid kid. I was always kind of a shy kid, and I'm still shy. People will disagree with that, but I'm still shy. It's hard for me to get out and talk about myself. And I think it was 2 years ago that you and I were on a panel, and somebody said, can you talk about this? And I was like, I was having a panic, and my boss was like, you talk all the time. I'm like, yeah, kind of do. But I don't generally talk about myself that much. So I guess I would say, like, just don't. Don't be afraid to say things. Don't be afraid to be yourself, because I am a talkative person, I have to say. But I still will be very quiet in large meetings, because I want to get the lay of the land before I say anything, right? I'm not a kind of, I don't think on my feet very well, which is, people always say, oh, you should teach. But it's like, I don't think on my feet very well. I would not be good at that. I need to sit and digest and then come up with some thoughts. So I think that's the advice I would give my younger self. It's like, yeah, that's just how you are. Just live it and own it.
Okay. So how did SWE fit into the background of your career?
I was a charter member of the Rensselaer section, but I was not active in SWE at all. When I was at JPL, I went to a meeting or two when I lived out in the Los Angeles area. It wasn't till I went to IBM, and as I say, that was not a good environment for women, that specific part of IBM. I went to a SWE meeting, and it felt really good to go to the SWE meeting, and that was kind of nice. But I'm again being kind of a shy person. I won't like put myself out there. But Felicitas Saez is the master of drawing people in. She'll give you like one thing to do, and then she'll give you another thing to do. And so really, she identified that one of the things I would be good at is the kind of the behind the scenes structure, right? So she assigned me to find speakers and find rooms to have monthly meetings and things like that. And she kind of drew me in piece by piece, and then I joined the editorial board for the magazine. And I think that's when I really got committed to the organization, was I met people from all over, and they were talking about, what are the issues that women in engineering are facing. And, when you're young, often you think it's about you. And then when you hear these other people talk, you're like, oh, okay, this is sort of like a generalized thing, and you start to think about what you can do to help. And I think joining the editorial board was probably the turning point that, that got me hooked into being active in SWE. Because from that point of view, from that time on, I started attending meetings regularly, and then I was a section representative for a while, and then I was section president of Baltimore, Washington, and then I was section representative again, and I joined a couple other national committees, and it was, I think that was probably what it was, and it's always given me maybe an outlet for my volunteer needs. My parents were very big on doing volunteer stuff in the community, and my manager now in Northrop, she's like, you've done a lot of stuff. I mean, yeah, but it, you know, day to day, it just sort of feels like my life. But when you look back on it, it's kind of like, well, I have done a lot of stuff. But SWE has always been a place for me to meet my friends and to kind of talk things through and to say, like, you know, is there something odd about this situation or is it me? And luckily at SWE, that people would be like, that's just you. That's good. That's what good friends do. Right? It's just you. So it's always kind of been in the background, but again, it's been a delightful way to feel like I'm doing something more than just earning a paycheck.
Okay.
Not that that's a bad thing.
Do you think that your involvement with SWE has impacted your career at all?
I don't think that, you know, I don't think any of my employers looked at it and said, oh, look, she's active in SWE and that's a good thing. But I think it has helped me be more confident with who I am. And it's in a strange way, it makes me feel like if I say something wrong, I just realize it's not going to, like, it's not going to be the end of the world because I'm not in politics, so. It's not going to ruin my career. I think it's that my involvement in SWE has been more about being who I am and realizing that these are the strengths I can take back into work more than so Northrop Grumman is the first company I've worked for that actually pays for me to come to the SWE conference. I've always paid on my own. I still have to take vacation to do it, but at least they pay for the hotel. And they're the first ones that really, on my performance appraisal, they'll put things that I've done for SWE in there. So it's kind of an odd feeling for me because it's always been very separate from what I do at work. Mm-hmm. And now I feel, because Northrop does actually value that, I'm finding that I'm identifying younger women at work and trying to get them to sort of get the same benefits I have. And two of them, this is their first SWE conference they came. So I'm very excited about that. So it's always, I think, as I say, it's not a direct one-to-one where the employer thought, what a great thing, but I think it's helped me be more comfortable with me.
Okay. I was reading through your fellow packet, and...
I need a copy of that.
From the archives.
Uh-huh.
And I saw that you were president of the Baltimore-Washington section. Mm-hmm. In 2000, mm-hmm. when that section was also hosting the national conference, as it was called then.
Yes.
And I read that you were very instrumental in keeping the section going.
That was my job.
When so many people were pulled away to run this national conference. Mm-hmm. And at that time, the SWE sections were largely responsible for a lot of the conference management.
That's right.
So can you tell me about that experience?
It was an interesting experience. And Suzanne Genesis was the one who twisted my arm into doing that. And I think it's because I'm very comfortable with change, and I'm comfortable with setting higher and lower expectations based on what's needed. Before we had the conference, we had monthly dinner meetings, we had a newsletter, and there were like a lot of things that were happening that we just weren't going to have the volunteer base to do leading up to the 2000 conference. Was the conference by then? So when did they change from convention to conference?
It was conference by then.
I think that might have been.
They changed in the 1990s.
I was going to say, I think that might have been the first one that was actually a conference. Mm-hmm. So I was okay. So I reached out and I got some people who weren't necessarily that active in SWE and asked them to do, using the Felicita Saez technique, asked them to do very specific things. And I said, if we don't put out a newsletter every month, that's going to be okay. So let's target September, December, right? So just scaling back those things. And if we don't have a dinner meeting, if we have a social instead of having a meeting with a speaker, we can do that, because the volunteers who were really committed to the organization were committed to the conference planning, and as they should be. So I think maybe that was, so I was the president that year and then the year following, because then all the conference people were all burned out, right? So it took them a little while to recover. And I think just lowering the expectations of what was going to happen made everybody a little more comfortable. I think a couple of the volunteers that I had pulled in that weren't particularly active, because the expectations were a little lower, I don't think maybe they didn't feel like they achieved much, because a couple of them just left right after that. So I've always been a little disappointed in that maybe I didn't make them I'd make them feel like, you know, I know it's not a lot, but it's what's keeping the section sort of one foot in front of the other. And then I think the other thing I did was I identified Diana Jock as the next president, because I knew that she could also pick it up from kind of this low point and then rebuild it. And I did have to have some conversations with her about, look, don't think it's going to be like it was before the conference. We'll get back there, but it's your job to transition it back there. And I think she did a wonderful job.
Okay. Can you talk about these SWE projects and initiatives that you've been involved in or committees that are particularly important or meaningful to you?
Well, I was the bylaws. I was on the bylaws committee because I like all the structural stuff. And I think you said earlier that I was on the audit committee. I don't believe I was ever on the audit committee. I might have been for Baltimore, Washington, but not the national one. Yeah, okay. I think I might for the Baltimore, Washington section, because I don't have a lot of audit experience. So the bylaws, because I like the structural stuff and I like to read the details, hence the expertise in the mil specs. It was a good fit. It was during this gigantic transition in SWE, and so it was a tad overwhelming because every section was supposed to rewrite their section bylaws. And we're still going through that as far as I can see. It completely burned me out. I was just like, I gotta get out of here. And I walked away from SWE for a little while, I have to say. I don't know, I need to talk to, maybe our parliamentarian is the right person, as to whether there's a way to do what we're doing without every section having to deal with this. Because it was 400 sets of bylaws, and if the bylaws committee took 10 minutes for each one, that's a lot of time for a volunteer organization. We kind of stumbled through it. I don't feel particularly proud of my job there, but it's done. And apparently SWE has managed to survive. And now we're doing it again. But, you know, I've done a lot of work with IEEE, and IEEE, the sections don't have their own bylaws. But it could be that they just have a different financial structure, because they have bylaws at the region level. And so every section just works on the, so they only have, how many, they have 10 regions. So they only have 10 sets of bylaws they have to deal with. And I'm wondering if SWE can't go to something like that, because this just seems, it seems like there's a lot of churn at the level. So as I say, I was involved in the bylaws, and I still work on the Baltimore, Washington bylaws, but no big things like that. I think my favorite thing was the editorial board for the magazine. And I joined up again because I was talking to Ann Peruzic last year, and I just kind of wanted to see how it was different from when I was on, was it like 95, 97, something like that. In those days, we'd come up with ideas, but then as the editorial board people, you had to go out and find somebody to write it and kind of push them along. And it was at the same time I was working at the National Academies, and it was just too much like what I was doing at work. I can't do this anymore. But now you can feel free to have a lot more crazy ideas, because there's more, I don't know, professional support, right? So if somebody who, if you say you have this idea of, you know, some sort of women in engineering and you want to know a specific thing, now we have professional writers who know kind of how to find that information, and you working with the archives, that same kind of thing is people who have that kind of expertise, which I don't particularly have. And it's kind of nice to say, okay, well, I can see there's this idea, but I'm not the right person to do it. Whereas before it was kind of like, once it was your idea, you had to do it, and that was a little inhibiting, I have to say. So I'm enjoying doing that, and I've always enjoyed just doing the things with the section. It's always fun meeting all the people in the area, and mostly I just do kind of organizational things. I was the teller for 3 years, something like that. I'm really bad about keeping track. I know some people, I see their SWE resumes and they have all the dates. I'm like, I don't know, I did these things. And I always joke that I was like, I volunteered to be the teller because it's literally the least amount of work you can do and still be an officer in SWE. And then we had all kinds of crazy election controversies and it was hard work. It's like unfair. I was just supposed to be able to sign the report and go away. But no, it was, I enjoyed doing that. When Jana was president, it was really, she was lovely to work with. Mm-hmm. So I kind of enjoyed that. I handed that off to Cheryl Manning this year, so she'll do a good job too.
Okay. This is going to be a fun question. How has SWE changed over the time that you've been involved with it?
Oh my gosh. So I don't know what the membership was. So if you think about from the time I got active, so 1992, I don't really know because I was just an occasional person, but if you think about the time when I was active, the membership has grown gigantically. It's always been one thing that stayed the same is that it has a very strong collegiate presence, which I appreciate as an organization, a nice balance between professional and collegiate. And size tremendously. It's grown tremendously. And I remember when, I think it was Peggy Lane was president, and she said that the goal was for SWE to be the authority on women in engineering. And I told her yesterday when I was talking to her, I said, I think I scoffed at that idea at the time you came up with it. And yet now you look at it and it is like when organizations are looking for, women in technical fields, SWE is one of the places they come. And that's pretty neat. It makes me feel good about being part of the organization. I think, though, that one of the things that I'm not particularly happy about is it looks more now less like a member-driven organization and more like a staff-driven organization. And I don't know that that sits particularly well with me. Maybe it's the cost of being the go-to organization for women in engineering is to have the staff be the kind of continuing presence. Maybe that's the trade-off you make for being an expert in something. But it's changed tremendously. And we were joking around about when the conferences were much smaller, the giveaways were better.
What do you hope SWE will accomplish in the future?
Well, I like the idea. I'm very pleased with the idea that it's now something that people who aren't in engineering or who aren't, in technical fields see as a place to find information. I really like that SWE does the whole State of Women in Engineering, and I love that issue of the magazine that kind of does the summary of a lot of things. I really enjoy that. I hope that becomes a core part of it, but I don't want to see it lose the person-to-person member-driven stuff that helps women, become engineers, go to school, transition into work, deal with all that kind of middle life stuff where you're trying to decide where to live and whether you have children or where the children go to school and all that stuff. And then come back and be more active and SWE towards, as your children are out and grown or you're more established in your career and you have time and things like that. I hope that continues to be a place where women feel like they want to come and be part of the organization.
Okay. Do you have any advice for current and future women engineers that you want to share?
I don't know that I have any particular advice. I think, as I said, what I would advise my younger self is to be more confident. But, you know, I have to tell you that the young women that I'm working with now, they are more confident. And maybe that advice is no longer needed, but I think probably it still is, because I think maybe they're seeming more confident on the outside, but maybe they're not. So I that would be my advice, is like, you know, and don't be afraid to say, like, oh, yeah, I got that one wrong, because that's a lot of the problems I have at work are people who will never say they were wrong. It's like, yep, you got to, sometimes you're going to get it wrong. Don't be afraid. Don't be afraid to do something because you're afraid you'll get it wrong.
Okay. Is there anything else you would like to share?
I think you've covered a lot of things.
Okay.
I've told you many things about myself that I don't know that I've told other people. So, like, see, you asked just the right questions.
All right. Well, thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you, Troy. I really enjoyed it, and I hope it goes well with your other archivey stuff.
Yeah, it will.
Thanks.